Okay, let's resume. The time is now 3:12 p.m. The next item on the board agenda will go back to number 80, abortion of viable fetus. And just for the record, now Mr. Dunn is rejoining the board as the designee of the Attorney General. Let's hear from proponents first. I think we've had variations of this before. It might be helpful, among other things, for proponents to indicate perhaps how this measure differs from previous version. But Mr. Lawrence, if you'll identify yourself with the record, please.
Michael Lawrence, number 24958, appearing for it as a proponent of the initiative.
Thank you. Is there, as I've indicated before, the first item, of course, is for the board to make sure that it understands the measure, but sometimes if there's some things that you want to point out about the measure that, in particular, any differences, feel free to go right ahead.
Sure. There's only really one difference here between this version and the prior previously submitted version, and that's simply a substitution of the term late-term abortion for the expression abortion of viable fetuses. And we made that simply to use vocabulary that we thought would be more accessible and comprehensible to the voters.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Lawrence?
Was there any discussion last time on the use of that term? I didn't participate in the last one, so.
There was not, to my recollection.
Mr. Carden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had one question, and I note that the measure, as you say, creates a new definition of late-term abortion, so that the measure now defines abortion and defines late-term abortion. And in Section 12-37.3-103 of the proposed measure, it talks about reports by physicians. That language, going down about four lines where it says Colorado's interest in protection of the unborn child, any physician who has performed a late-term abortion or abortions must file a report of each such abortion performed by the department. And then, rather than using the terminology late-term abortion, it uses the term abortion through the rest of that particular section. And my question to you is, are the reporting provisions of 1237.3103 specific to late-term abortions or to both late-term abortions and abortions? And to jump ahead, the staff draft of the title is concerning the regulation of late-term abortions, so I wanted to clarify. Or if you wouldn't mind explaining that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Section 103 requires reports only for late-term abortions, not for abortions generally, but only late-term abortions. We think that sentence makes it clear to promote the state of Colorado's interest in protecting an unborn child. A physician who has performed a late-term abortion / abortions would be another way to read it. But late-term is not meant to define the word abortion singularly by itself, but also abortions plurally there. And then the following sentence is that such reports of late-term abortions will be sent to the Department of Public Health. So we believe the grammar of the sentence makes it clear that this is something that will apply only to late-term abortions.
So, just to follow up, where the word abortion appears in paragraph under 103.1, paragraphs A, D, E, F, G, H, and J, that refers to the definition late-term abortion rather than the definition for an abortion?
As the introducing sentence goes to the subparts of that, the reports are reports prepared only for late-term abortions, and therefore implicitly throughout the lettered subsections, those are all reports that are generated for late-term abortions. And so implicitly, the reports, for example, on A, the identification of the physician who performed the abortion, refers to an abortion that is a late-term abortion only. There's no reporting requirement for non-late-term abortions, and therefore it wouldn't make sense to read it in any other way.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Lawrence? If not, let's move then to discussion of or consideration of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement of the Constitution. The board has found that a previous version did comply with the single subject requirement. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify on. But if anybody wants to testify on this issue, please let me know. Any discussion by the board on the single subject question? Mr. Carton.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the title board find that measure proposed initiative 2005-2006, number 80, contains a single subject and that the board has jurisdiction to set a title for number 80.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the staff drafts, Ms. Gomez is projecting them onto the screen. Mr. Lawrence, have you had a chance to look at the staff draft, and do you have any comment?
I have had a chance to look at it. I don't have any comments. I'm happy to answer any questions the board has.
The staff draft is acceptable to you?
It is.
Discussion by the board? Mr. Dunn?
I hope I'm not rehashing the discussion of last time. I wasn't here for that or didn't participate in that. But the use of the phrase late-term abortion, I know it defines it in the title and in the measure, which is probably sufficient. My only concern is that the phrase itself, I think, in the general perception of the public is that it's referring to third trimester or some other type of, I don't want to use the word late term, but a late term abortion, and that maybe misleading to the public, maybe that's sufficiently offset by the provision of a definition, but I just wanted to raise that point for discussion.
I think there was, as I recall, there was discussion about the term, and I think it was, as I recall, it was very important to the board, and I think we even had some advice from counsel about this, that we should include in the titles both the definition of abortion and late term abortion. Mr. Lawrence, how do you remember it?
I remember it in the same manner, that I think to the extent that the definition might have a lack of clarity because it's a term of common usage where the definition isn't particularly rigorous or precise, to the extent that the common usage may have that defect. That defect is taken out by the fact that we have the very precise definition from the statute included in the title.
And a question for counsel, if a phrase would otherwise qualify as a catchphrase under the case law, can that be neutralized by providing a contrary definition?
Actually, what we discussed the last time is that there was a case from several years ago that talked about what happens if you have a term that is radically different from the commonly understood definition of that term. And so we decided that the definition of abortion needed to be included. Now, with regard to late-term abortion, that is a term that is used in the measure itself, and it's appropriate to not only use the term as it's used in the measure, but also to define it. I think it may be somewhat misleading if you use a term other than late-term abortion and then set forth the definition. It seems to me it's most accurate to just restate both the term itself and the definition in the measure.
Mr. Dunn, go ahead.
I was only going to add then, with respect to the drafting of the title, it may make more sense or maybe more appropriate then just to move the definitional phrase up to right after the use of late-term abortion in line one and line two.
I'm sorry. Instead of
starting out.
Well,
that's a single subject, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to interfere with the single subject clause, but
yeah.
I was wondering if there's a way to get the definitional phrase as close to the use of the term as possible. But maybe it's close enough.
It's kind of hard. I mean, we do have to first state the single subject, and then the next two clauses are the definitions. But they're kind of involved.
I think it's probably as good as we can get that one.
Further discussion about the staff drafts? Not. Is there a motion to adopt the staff drafts?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the staff draft for proposed initiative 2005-2006, number 80.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 80, and the time is 3:24 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's turn to the next agenda item. As I indicated earlier, number 87 was withdrawn by the proponents, so the next item on the board's agenda is number 93, PERA reform. And earlier, the first the board would like to hear from proponents and find out to make sure that the board understands the measure and see if the board has any questions about the measure itself. So if I could first hear from proponents, if you could identify your proponents. If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Barry Polson.
My name is Christine Bird.
Thank you.
We like to answer any questions you have about the draft.
Well,
thank you.
Let me just say that we've looked at the title and we have no objections to what the Senate think it accurately our intention.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions about the measure that the board has for the proponents? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the measure that's before the title board right now, there were some changes made between the review and comment version and the version that's in front of the title board right now. I'd just like to know whether those changes you feel are in direct response to questions that were raised in the review and comment hearing?
Yes, they were. And I think that in terms of specific changes that were requested, changes involve mainly clarification of language involved in oversight of the board, the oversight of the program. I think that one of the questions was, could this be in the state treasurer's office, budget planning office of the governor? decision was place this in the state planning and budget office.
In terms of that placement, as I understand the measure, and I'm trying to get sort of from a global perspective of what's going on here, in terms of the PRA entity itself. There's two provisions, one that says that PRA is subject to the administrative direction of OSPB, as well as then the new Board of Trustees is created within OSPB in the governor's office. Is that correct?
That's right.
So the way that I've always viewed PRA as it exists right now, I think what we commonly refer to it as a special purpose authority, that it's a state entity, it's created by state statute, but it's not part of what I would think of traditional state government in terms of the three branches of government. It's something else. Is the point of making PRA subject to administrative direction by OSPB and putting the trustees within OSPB, is PARA by this measure being pulled into the executive branch of state government?
No, I think that the purpose is mainly one of oversight. Our perception is that this is based on our review of similar state pension programs, especially in Michigan, that by placing it within the state office of planning and budget, which is essentially what the Michigan reform involved, that the purpose is to establish a more effective oversight.
And in terms of that oversight, other than being subject to administrative direction by OSPB, and I'm not quite sure what that is, the measure itself doesn't provide for any direct oversight, is there? I mean, for example, the powers of the Board of Trustees in terms of making certain decisions isn't contingent upon approval of the director of OSPB. I didn't see any correlation between other than creating the board within OSPB, there is no oversight? I mean, you haven't changed anything in terms of the statutory authorization for OSPB in regard to PARA. And other than administrative direction, which I don't quite know what that means, I mean, I don't know what your measure provides. And the reason that I'm asking is, for example, the language that you've changed that used to say that it wasn't subject to administrative direction, and now it is, that's usually the kind of language that's specifically used to designate a special purpose authority, for example, which are excluded from the definition of state for TABOR purposes. PARA right now is considered a special purpose authority and is excluded from the state. Because now you've made them subject to administrative direction of OSPB, of an entity of the state, it no longer qualifies under the statutory definition of a special purpose authority for TABOR purposes. And so I don't know whether that means now PRA is now included within the state limit on fiscal year spending, for example. I don't know, and that's why I'm trying to get this feel. I don't know whether that would have personnel implications in terms of right now, because PRA is outside of the state system, whether by the oversight of OSPB that's making it more of a state entity in terms of the requirement that state monies be in the state treasury and subject to appropriation, which is right now their monies are separate and apart because they're not part of the state. I'm just trying to get from sort of this global perspective of the oversight when you haven't really provided for any oversight other than this one statement. I'm just trying to figure out what your measure does and what how it might affect these types of areas.
I think the specific question that came up regarding the previous draft did involve the question of funding. And we have explicitly provided for this funding. And it's a very specific funding, and that is, in the language, is for that the legislature must provide funding for the oversight function of the state office of planning budget. That is, the idea that their current budget, of course, obviously doesn't provide for this type of oversight. So with regard to the funding for this, with regard to the intent, it's clear that this, the function of the state office of planning and budget, is clearly an oversight function. We haven't attempted to answer the question. The other types of questions you had involving personnel and so forth, our expectation is that that would be up to that office.
But again, can you point me to anything other than this language in terms of explaining to me what that oversight involves? Because it seems to me that the Board of Trustees' powers and duties in general haven't changed at all. And so, you know, in terms of them making decisions, what oversight is there for OSPB?
I would disagree that the functions of the board are certainly changed by this. And I think the background of this is that as it is currently constituted, PARA is subject to oversight by the State Treasurer's Office. At this point, the State Treasurer does sit on the board. I think our perception was that that oversight function was lacking, that for a variety of reasons, some of the problems that we've identified with PARA are a result of that lack of oversight. And so I think, first of all, that there is an oversight function that the state is performing now. Currently, it's performed by having the state treasurer serve on the board. This is a somewhat different oversight function. We have tried to make it more explicit, and we certainly have changed the function.
But it's not contingent upon any approval by OSPB.
That's true.
So other than sort of the physical location of the board within the office, and, you know, usually, like, through the budgetary process, you know, the governor's office submits a budget to the General Assembly, which includes funding for those various offices. And with the Board of Trustees within OSPB, I mean, it seems like perhaps there's a budgetary function now created by the fact that you've put the board actually in the office?
Well, I would disagree that we have not made changes in terms of this oversight function. I think if you look at the language of this, there is a reporting responsibility here that the board must make to the legislature. I think that the oversight function, of course, would be fulfill that mandate.
But there's no one, for example, like the director of the Office of State Planning and Budgeting, they're not on the Board of Trustees, similar to the situation with the treasurer or state auditor.
Precisely. So that person has, there's no conflict of interest because the director of that office does not serve on that board.
But yet you've given the director no authority to oversee the board, because other than placing it, physically creating the board within the office, you've not specified what that oversight function is or that they can have access to any records or anything else. Is that, am I missing something in the measure?
My understanding is that under the current board, there is an oversight function for the state treasurer, and in this case, it involves the state treasurer serving on the board. I think you'll see that the composition of the board changes with the state's appointment of board members by the governor's office. That does change the composition of the board. We have not attempted to make explicit the details of the oversight function, but that is certainly the expectation.
In terms of the measure in general, and you said that you were fine with the title as it's drafted, so I assume that you think that the statement of single subject is an accurate one, as reflected in the staff draft concerning retirement benefit plans for public employees in Colorado? Okay. In terms of... sort of the timing of the measure taking effect on January 1st of 2007, assuming that voters approve the measure, and understanding that the at the very end of the measure it provides that it's supposed to take effect on that date after the vote and after the certification. I assume that you're not trying to change the constitutional requirement that actually makes initiated measures effective upon declaration of the governor. In terms of the timing itself, assuming that it takes effect on January 1st, with the change of the makeup of the board, you've got four members that have to be elected. Those elections would then have to take place sometime after January 1st, and so for a while at least the board would not have those members. Is that correct? Until the elections could actually happen. Then you've got three members that are appointed by the governor, and I don't know in terms of, you don't make any mention of consent of the Senate, and I don't know whether or not there's any issue there in terms of the requirement under Article 4, Section 6 about governor's appointments of public officials subject to the consent of the Senate. But if consent is actually required, it seems, depending on when the governor makes those appointments, in terms of being a vacancy appointment when the General Assembly isn't in session yet, if it were to happen very early in January, or after the General Assembly has come into session where the persons can't actually take office until they've been confirmed by the Senate, then is there any potential that all you could have is two members of your board and you don't have a quorum operating in that early part?
There's no intention to go out of statute in terms of the Senate confirmation. So, you know, the language says that at the time of the appointments, the governor shall designate, et cetera. Those would obviously have to be at the time that those appointments were valid. So that requires the Senate confirmation, and then that would be the case. Your issue is concern about time. It seemed to me that there was specific language in here that kept the current board on until the new one was put into place.
And I guess I just saw the language that said that as of January 1st, the old board was abolished.
Right.
And so I just wasn't sure exactly how that transition would work. Especially with, you know, needing to get the recommended persons from the various groups that you've required in terms of the different expertise, the Bar Association, things like that. I mean, it seems like that would take some time for the governor to get a list. Then in terms of if Senate confirmation, that may take time, that you may end up in the situation where all you've got is the auditor and the treasurer.
Well, there'd be no intention of having a board that did not have a quorum.
Let's see. I think I'm not sure that I had any other questions. I did have a couple of questions on possible typographical errors that I wanted to ask you about. And I'm looking at page 10, which at the very beginning of the page it says Section 12 repeal. Then it has a Section 13, which has a new service credit table for certain employees. And about halfway down in that provision, it has a reference to Section 2451-603. And then it's subsection 1. And then there's just a 27. And then a paren, C close paren. And that doesn't conform to what I would call normal statutory references in terms of codification. And so I was just wondering if that might be a typo that we might need to consider in terms of correcting.
No, we responded to legislative counsel, and it's an
Okay, and then there's another one on page 14 of the draft, and it's in the head note to section 2451-1603, where it says employer and employee contributions, and the words and employee are capitalized. Usually in a head note, even though it's a new provision of law, it would be lowercase except for the initial cap, and so I was wondering whether and employee actually should be lowercase.
Sure.
Let me go back to the first possible typographical issue that Ms. Eubanks raised on page 10. Do you know what the correct reference is supposed to be there? Is it supposed to be 1C, 603-1C, or do you know? I mean, I'm not sure what 127C would be.
So I don't have any of the documents that far back with me. This is exactly as we at. This was the original submitted, and I don't have it. So.
We had gotten an email after the measure was submitted. Or an email that we received from Bob Hoban, and I think probably representing proponents, that he indicated he had a version that removed some codes and things that I think he thought was going to clean up some what I thought were formatting issues and so forth. And since it was tendered after the deadline for the board to consider today, we did not include it as the official version of the measure, and I don't have it with me. But if you have it, or if we have it, it might be useful to compare. I'm just wondering if that is somehow a product of coding or something like that.
I believe it probably is, because this was submitted as a Word document. The Legislative Council translates everything into Word Perfect, and there were a number of formatting differences that when we compared them, the originals, we saw that there were a number of changes in them. I'm going to ask Richard Westfall.
Mr. Westfall,
representing us too.
If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
I will, and I'll be happy to sign in as well. I wasn't planning on speaking. Richard Westfall, the law firm of Hale Friesen, on behalf of the proponents. When we went back and we did a very careful read of the original draft and prepared the red line and prepared the final version, we recognized that there were a couple typos that you've spotted, and there's one or two others as well. To be absolutely abundantly careful about the statutory obligation to make sure that there be no change that's not in direct response to a question posed by Legislative Legal Services. Those were all particular typos that were not caught by the questions that were posed by Legislative Legal Services. It's my legal position, and again, I thought it was important that I get up and present to you a legal position, that the reviser of statutes will have the ability to make any conforming changes that will be necessary. We felt, given the way that these measures play themselves out now, with opponents being able to make challenges for the smallest technical issue, that it was more important that given the fact that these typographical errors are very small, will have no substance, and I believe can very adequately be addressed by the reviser of statute, that it was more important in this context that we comply with a specific statutory obligation on behalf of proponents to make sure that any changes in the measure be only those changes that are in direct response to questions posed by Legislative Legal Services. And that's what we attempted to do.
Okay. Thank you. There are other questions from the board for the proponents? If not, let's turn then the next item of business before the board is whether or not the measure complies with the single subject requirement of the Constitution. And I don't have, is there anybody signed up who wishes to testify on that issue, whether the measure legally complies with the single subject requirement? If you'll come forward and identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming up, I forgot to make one disclosure that reminded me when Mr. Westfall came up. Mr. Westfall and I, just for the record, used to practice together. It's over a year ago, so I don't think it's a conflict. He also, Mr. Westfall and his firm also represent the Attorney General's office in litigation, and we're also opposite Mr. Westfall and his firm in other litigation, so there's probably other conflicts I've forgotten about, but those are the ones I remember, so I want to put that on the record. I don't think that infringes on my ability to be impartial here.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Eubanks.
And since we're making disclosures, Mr. Westfall has been retained by the General Assembly to represent a member in a particular legal matter. It has nothing to do with the measure before us today, but I did also want to make that disclosure for the record.
Okay, thank you. Okay, if you'll proceed, please. Okay.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mary Ulibarri, and I'm representing the employees of the University of Colorado Denver Staff Council, as well as the classified staff members of the University of Colorado. I'm also here on behalf for Statewide Liaison Council.
Could you spell your name?
You bet. Ulibarri.
Thank you very much. Go ahead and give us your testimony, please.
Yes. I'm actually looking at the page that was listed, the summary or the recap that was listed after the ballot initiative that the proponents put together. And there are numbers associated with, they go all the way down to 24. So I'm going to start on line 4. If you don't have that there. I've got the page numbers. If you have the ballot initiative in front of you, can go ahead with that.
Yes,
there is a recap page with numbers on it. You guys are not seeing that?
What is a recap page?
The title. Oh, yes. Okay, the staff draft.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
This is the staff draft, which we have not yet gotten to. If you have some issues with the proposed titles as drafted by staff, we'll come to that next.
Well, I actually do have some issues that are actually in the ballot proposal, and I do have the page numbers associated with that. The way I'm reading this ballot initiative, for one, it's 22 pages long, and you're talking about a single subject. The way I read it, I'm coming up with three separate subjects. The three separate subjects that I see, and it would be 24-51-202 on the bottom of page 4. That has to do with creating a new board of trustees. The second subject that I've come up with, that I'm seeing as a second subject, is 24-51-211 on page 9, which is stating reducing the amortization period that is deemed actuarially sound for the association's defined benefit plan trust funds. And the third subject that I am seeing is 24-51-1601, page 12, that states creating a new defined contribution plan, requiring employees of the existing defined contribution plan and employees hired on or after January 1st, 2007 to become members of the new defined contribution plan. The reason I am reading this as three separate subjects is because you're taking the para board and you're changing the entire makeup of the board with having, as this lady pointed out, governor appointees. That's a separate issue. And then if they were to take the amortization period of para now and reduce it from 40 years to 30 years, as it states on page 9 of the initiative, I would think that this fabricated crisis of para might just go away if that reduction of liabilities could go for 10 years. That, in my opinion, is another subject area. And then itself, creating from a pension plan, taking a new defined contribution plan, pensions now, PARA is now currently a defined benefit plan. I have some concerns about that. And there's some language in the ballot initiative that I'm afraid the voters do not understand. I'm actually an enrolled agent. I'm enrolled to practice before the Internal Revenue Service. And I don't think that most, I deal with a lot of tax clients that don't understand tax law. And something that's not in this initiative that should be is the fact that PARA members will not, are not now, nor will be in the future subject to Social Security. So what happens with this initiative is the protections of Social Security, and let me give you examples of some of the protections of Social Security.
Interrupting, I just want to make sure this relates to the question of whether the measure complies with a single subject requirement.
Okay, well, defined contribution plan is my, that I'm saying that that is another single subject. So I'm saying that there are three subjects in this particular ballot initiative.
Okay, thank you. And then we'll come back to, I mean, to the titles at some point, but the first obligation of the board is to determine whether the measure complies with a single subject requirement.
And I will end with saying that this is a 22-page document. It is a long, involved, I spent, and I am used to reading tax law for fun. I spent an entire Saturday on this ballot initiative. I mean, that's what I do for kicks. And it is a very complicated ballot initiative. And I know that, I mean, I deal with people on a regular basis that may not understand the language.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you. I don't believe I have anyone else signed up to testify, but is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the single subject question? And I, while we're on that, I would like to give the proponents an opportunity to respond to the arguments that the measure is more than one subject.
Well, we think your staff had it right, that it is indeed a single subject, and this initiative reflects in great degree House Bill 1083, which was killed in committee, got that far, so it clearly met the single subject rule, and Senate Bill 162, which is still moving forward, and also Senate Bill 174, in which case a discussion of the amortization schedules, the boards of trustees, the board of trustees rather, and the defined contribution plan are addressed. So clearly that legislation and the staff saw this as meeting the single subject rule. We agree.
Are there questions from the board? And I'm jumping ahead a little bit to the titles, which I'm, on the one hand, I'm trying to avoid, but it comes up because the titles, it is a requirement that the titles clearly express the single subject of the measure. And the staff draft expresses the single subject as concerning retirement benefit plans for public employees in Colorado. And I think you might have indicated this before, but is that a fair statement of what you believe the single subject to be? Thank you. I'll turn to board discussion concerning the question of single subject. Any discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks?
Sure. I'll get it started. I'm having problems, and I think it might be obvious from my questions that I asked the proponents. In terms of the OSPB involvement in the placement, in terms of sort of that necessary connection of, okay, we're dealing with retirement benefit plans, and in terms of if we find a single subject, then we may have a discussion of what a statement of the single subject may be. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree entirely with the statement as set forth in the staff draft right now. But what concerns me is in terms of the OSPB involvement. Understanding the proponent's explanation, there isn't anything textual in terms of that connection of oversight. I mean, you've got the Board of Trustees created within the office, but there's no authority given to the director for any sort of oversight. I'm not sure what administrative direction means in terms of that reference. Like I say, that language, I mean, it's taking language that's usually used for an opposite or different purpose, which is to make it clear that something is not part of state government. But again, OSPB then in the measure is not given, other than that general statement, is not given any specific oversight authority. None of the decisions by the board is required to be approved by OSPB. OSPB isn't given any authority to have access to the records of PRA, which are generally viewed, I think, as confidential. I think in terms of trying to equate it to the treasurer's role in PRA, I think that's because he's a board member, versus here you don't have the director of OSPB being part of the board. I mean, you still have the treasurer, you still have the state auditor. And so I'm having difficulty there, especially because there may be unintended consequences of giving administrative direction to OSPB in terms of now, at least according to the statutory definition of special purpose authority for the state's Tabor limit, PARA no longer qualifies because it is subject to administrative direction of OSPB in terms of whatever that means. And so I just don't, I'm not sure I see the connection, the necessary connection, why you have to have OSPB, the placement of the board in OSPB, or supposedly the administrative oversight in, as it relates to the functions of the board or the operations of the association or pension plans or anything else. It's just sort of there. And that's, I'm sort of stuck on that, both in terms of whether there's some sort of hidden complications by doing this that might surprise voters, as well as in terms of just the general test for single subject, which talks about, you know, relates to more than one subject, and if it has at least two distinct and separate purposes which are not dependent upon or connected with each other. And from the text of the measure, I'm not sure of the connection between OSPB and the Board of Trustees and the association. And so I'll just throw that out for discussion.
Well, I think you raised a lot of good questions. But I'm not sure in my mind what extent to take that as having some effect on our single subject analysis. I don't know what administrative oversight OSPB will have, but I am. You indicated. I think the test is the test is whether or not there's two separate and distinct purposes. I haven't yet gotten to that point where I can identify separate and distinct purposes. Pretty broad subject. If it's something like the way it's expressed in this staff draft, and I think subject to something like retirement benefit plans for public employees, the governing board and how it fits into state government, all of that arguably is related. And it's true, I don't know the answers to some of the questions that you've raised, but I don't know that they also indicate separate purposes. They may be legal questions that are going to have to be resolved if the measure passes, but I just can't necessarily identify separate purposes at this point.
Is that a question of implementation? The measure on its face says that it's subject to the administrative direction of OSPB. Take that on its face, and then it's a matter of implementation and whether or not there, I don't have enough experience to know, but whether or not that has any practical effect or not is one of implementation rather than subject matter.
I mean, my response to that is yes, I'm not sure what administrative direction there will be. I mean, in its form is adopted. I mean, I actually have some ideas about what it could mean if faced with implementing this. I have some theories about it, but I don't have answers. But I think those are the kinds of things that may have to be addressed in implementation. You know, so it's, I'm not sure they rise to the level of things that the board has to figure out at this point. But I don't know. I'm just kind of where I am at this point. I think there's lots of good questions here, but it's not unusual for the board to have a measure that where questions have arisen about exactly how something will be implemented or what one portion of the measure means. But as Ms. Eubanks pointed out, the real test is whether or not there's separate and distinct purposes here. Don't see that yet.
And I guess where I'm sort of caught up is in terms of the connection of the plans or PRA or the board or whatever. I mean, what is it about the OSPB involvement that makes is necessary or connected to the other changes that are being made? I mean, you could revamp the board. You could do everything that they're doing in terms of establishing a new defined contribution plan, those sorts of things, but there's no connection, I think it's hard to make the connection between putting OSPB in some way and not knowing the connection, because then they're given no role in the plans or with the board or in any decisions or access to records. I say that's my difficulty, is in terms of it's there, but is it connected somehow?
We want to give the proponents.
And that's, you know, pardon?
I was just asking if we wanted to give the proponents an opportunity to respond to some of the.
Sure, that's fine.
It might be helpful if there was some testimony about the issues that are being raised. Mr. Westfall.
Thank you, Mr. Hodge. I can just make a very quick observation based upon a conversation with a client, with the two proponents. This was not meant as any major earth-shattering structural change along the lines that would be suggested by Ms. Eubanks' questions, and we certainly recognize, you know, the spirit in which those questions were presented. Certainly in light of issues such as Tabor and things like that, and those are very serious issues. But it wasn't intended to make any of those major changes that we're talking about. The change to get it within OSPB, and again, that's why there is no discussion of any of a laundry list of oversight functions that can and should be performed by OSPB. All is intended is just a simple extra set of eyes by having the board placed underneath OSPB. So given the normal budget functions that OSPB performs for the governor, it was just thought that it would be very helpful as one extra layer of oversight to just have the entity within OSPB, but not provide for all the other things that you're talking about, because that would raise those very questions that you're presenting. So I think just by merely housing it within, just physically within OSPB, is not meant to create any of the major structural changes that would either raise single subject problems or Tabor problems. None of that's intended. It's merely to have the extra set of eyes by OSPB, and again, comparing and contrasting that with having the treasurer, who actually sits on the board. Here, the treasurer will be free as an independent board member to continue to perform that important role as a trustee of the para board, but not affect any major structural change.
But wouldn't it be true that as being put in OSPB, then the budget for the board, and I mean, I don't know, presumably maybe the whole association is now going to need to be in the budget for the governor's office, because OSPB, I mean, it's created in that office. It's now within the executive branch of government. And I mean, that's how it normally, that's why I say I
understand that's a huge potential effect, but that's not what was intended, and we believe it's silent on that and can be interpreted as to preserve its independence.
Even though now it doesn't qualify as a special purpose authority because it's under the administrative direction. I mean, I don't know. You know, it still says it's an instrumentality, but it's under administrative direction, and so I don't know what it is.
I think there'll
be a fourth category. I don't know.
The proponent, my client, can speak on it.
If I could respond to the specific question about funding. In fact, this was a question that was raised earlier. Staff, legal staff. The question was, how should this oversight function be funded? And so that was the reason why we put the language into this. Funding for the oversight function would be legislature. We wanted to specifically distinguish between an oversight function for Westview and funding of the pension system. I think that we tried to design the language to accomplish that objective. I should also add that in writing this legislation, we were very much influenced by Michigan legislation. In fact, enacted this similar reform of their state. Also placed an oversight function in their office of state planning budget. Drafted this. There was a discussion about how detailed we should make this. And to what extent should we make much more explicit some of these provisions? And the decision was made. Consultation with legislative legal staff. Some of those questions would be resolved in enabling legislation. That's the background for why we have this particular.
And I appreciate that, and I understand in terms of the language that was added in terms of the funding for OSPB as it relates to its functions. In relation to the to PRA, but the board, by creating it within the office of the governor, within OSPB, which is in the office of the governor, it's created in the executive branch of government, and the General Assembly has the authority to appropriate monies. The governor's office has to get its budget approved and receive appropriations for all of its functions. And understanding funding the oversight function of OSPB versus the fact that you've put the board within the office, it's now within the executive branch, that's what concerns me in terms of, to give OSPB an oversight function and not change the structure in terms of PRA being a special purpose authority and being outside the traditional three branches of government versus the fact that you've brought the board in, that's what concerns me, because now they're within the executive branch and in terms of the normal budgeting process, whereas before they're outside of that.
Let me respond to the question. I have a question because my understanding is that the office does exercise an oversight function for a variety of institutions, some of which are directly within its purview and directly under its budget, some of which are not. Is that right?
I believe it has that responsibility in terms of the executive branch of government. But that's it. And so then that raises the issue, is PRA now part of the executive branch of government in terms of that
only
change?
In the sense that branch would exercise its function, as I say. I think our decision was not to try to make explicit a whole set of details in terms of how that oversight would be exercised. We did not try to.
Okay, thank you.
Further discussion by the board? It still seems to me that likely a single subject, a broad subject, and I've also been looking at the statute that implements the constitutional single subject requirement and some of the tests and explanations that are provided there, and I, for example, the statute basically says the board should apply the same judicial standards to the single subject requirement that are used for bills. And I have not looked at the bills that were introduced in the current session. certainly I don't think there's been, I'm not aware of any challenges to whether or not any of those measures violate the single subject requirement for bills. I'm going to, you know, at this point assume that they were fairly broad measures with similar provisions, and it seems like a similar standard would apply here, but maybe I'm presuming a lot. But I'm also looking at the test that have been given to us about whether or not the measures have, you know, surreptitious provisions or incongruous subjects within the measure and so forth. So I'm just not there yet on seeing a violation of the single subject requirement, but still open to being persuaded. But
Mr. Dunn?
I'm still not convinced, even if some of the kind of worst-case scenarios you're talking about it impacting the executive branch and then falling under the budgetary provisions of that process, even if that were true, if that would constitute a separate subject, or whether that maybe is a title issue that could be cured by adding that the title that it is a move to OSPB. I think I share the sentiments. I think that the single subject, as stated in the staff draft, covers the measure.
Well, for the sake of seeing if we can move forward, I'll go ahead and offer a motion and see if there's a second. I'll move that the board find that the measure comprises a single subject and that the board proceed to set titles for the measure. Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion on the motion?
I think I just want to say that I'll probably be a no vote, and I don't think there's any surprise there. I don't see, based on the text of the measure, the connection, the necessary connection, that in terms of revamping the board, doing defined contribution plans, the connection with OSPB, because the measure is basically silent in terms of the role of OSPB, and so I just don't see how that's dependent or connected to each other. And so I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Then let's turn to the staff draft. And Ms. Gomez will project it onto the screen. First, I'd like to hear from proponents and ask if you've had a chance. I think you indicated actually at the beginning that you were fine with the staff draft, but perhaps if you could remind me if that was your opinion.
We have no objection to the staff draft.
Thank you. Are there others then that want to address the staff draft? Ms. Ulibarri, I'm sorry, and I may have you be saying your name wrong, and I apologize.
That's fine.
Okay.
Well.
Oh, thanks. If you'd like to come forward and then address the staff draft, please.
The biggest area of concern that I have with this particular ballot initiative is that the voters will have no way of knowing that public employees do not pay into Social Security. This ballot initiative 93 is taking a defined benefit plan and all of its advantages, and I'm not just talking about retirement here. A defined benefit plan includes life insurance, disability coverage, as well as survivorship benefits. This defined contribution plan in ballot 93 covers none of that. That is my concern. There is no Social Security benefits for the employees to fall back on. In other words, this ballot initiative, in my opinion, is a disguised 401k plan, and that's what it looks like to me. I do not see the benefits of changing this plan, because a defined benefit plan is much more than a retirement account. It has the disability component, which is very important, as well as the survivorship. So I think the public and the voters need to understand, and they need to know, that public employees and whether it be a defined benefit plan or whether this ballot initiative passes on January 1st, 2007, will not pay into Social Security. Because when people understand that about public employees, teachers and state troopers and classified staff employees do not have Social Security benefits to fall back on. This is our retirement plan, and it would stay the same, except what's happening in this ballot initiative is that those advantages that we have with our para-defined benefit plan are going to go away. That is my concern.
And could you restate again, what are the benefits that go away?
Well, if you look on number 20, line 22 of the ballot title and submission clause that was put, and I'm just going to go ahead and read that line, and authorizing members of the defined contribution plan to participate in the optional. The word optional here means you have to pay additional dollars for it. Right now, para defined benefit plans provides us a life insurance benefit as well as survivorship benefits for our under age 18 children, as well as disabled benefits if we become disabled while we are working. Social Security does something similar to that as well. As you're all aware, you may even pay into Social Security, that if you were to die before your children is of age 18, that Social Security would pay that child up until the time that they turn 18. Those are the types of things that are being lost with this defined contribution plan. Because I do not see in anywhere in this ballot legislation that information being addressed. And that's my concern. So in other words, a teacher, and I'll give the example that I've given other people. A teacher goes to Colorado State University at age 22, gets a bachelor's degree in education and starts to teach. 10 years go by, she has a child that's 10 years old, all right? She dies. Under this new plan, January 1st, 2007, with this teacher that is now dead, the child may have, or the family would have, the employer contribution and the employee contribution. They would have that. But there would be no guarantee of benefits up to age 18 for that child. These are the things that are missing. If that same teacher didn't die but became disabled, there are no protections that I can see. Now, maybe the proponents want to talk about this. I cannot see any disability. Yes, it says optional, life insurance, long-term care insurance, which is not disability. Voluntary investment, which means they can invest in whatever they want, and health care programs. Where's the disability in this? I don't see any issue here being addressed on disability at all. Right now, under the defined benefit plan, if I was to get disabled tomorrow, I would be covered under PERA's disability plan. It's not just a retirement plan, and that's what I'm concerned about here. I'm concerned about the new teachers coming in January 1st, 2007 that will never have paid into Social Security. They just graduated from college. They don't have any Social Security credits, hence they're not going to have any disability credits if something happens to them along the way. So those are my concerns with this ballot initiative.
Any questions?
Yes.
Could that be cured
by simply adding language that the measure simply removes certain existing benefits?
Well, I think that voters have a right to understand this legislation. If they're going to be voting on it, it should be clear. The problem is that the voters don't understand that we don't have Social Security. And the voters don't understand that this new plan won't have those protections similar to Social Security or similar to what we have now. So by adding language, now if the proponents want to say that this defined contribution plan is going to have disability benefits within it, then that needs to be clearer to me, needs to be clearer to the voters. So there needs to be, in my opinion, some additional language added, especially the Social Security piece. Voters are not aware that public employees don't pay into Social Security. This is our only retirement account. We cannot fall back. In other words, many private employers will will you'll work for them, and you'll have an option to pay into a 401k plan, and you'll also be covered by Social Security because you have to pay into Social Security. Hence, if anything happens to you, you're going to be taken care of. You have Social Security disability. If you're close to death, you can also apply for that. So that's my concern. So there needs to be some language that states in here that, yes, there's disability coverage, there's life insurance coverage, there's long-term disability coverage. If, you know, optional means additional dollars to me. If they want to clear that up and say that that's not true, that's fine. I can understand that, and I can clarify that. The piece that's missing with this is all of those guarantees that we have through Social Security or through PARA right now. I'm a current PARA member, and if I'm disabled, I'll be okay. If I had a child that was under 18, that child would be taken care of until that child reaches majority. I don't see any of that, and that's my concern. That answer your question at all?
It does, thank you.
Maybe if we could hear from proponents as well.
Without getting into the political debate defining the merits of the case, let me remind everyone that the changes to the defined contribution plan affect new employees. And so, yes, it is very much like a 401k plan. They own it. It's their private property right. They invest those dollars in a professionally managed plan. They choose among five plans that PARA manages, same plans that they'll be managing for their defined benefit folks. And if they want additional insurances, such as the type this lady's defined, there's no prohibition from them to buy those additional insurances. They actually will make a lot more money in this plan than they would in Social Security or in PARA if they're a new employee and they have the time to put their time into saving and investing. For current employees over the age of 40, nothing really changes for them. They still have everything that's been promised to them, with this exception. They start to, their contribution to their own retirement increases in 0.5% increments every year until it matches the taxpayer contribution. And for current retirees, nothing changes for them. They still get everything that they have. The unfunded liability is covered in two ways. One, the additional funds of existing employee of current PARA members in the defined benefit program, increasing their contribution to match the taxpayer contribution. And secondarily, a reallocation of the taxpayer contribution for new employees, such that the percentage goes to the employee and the rest goes to fund the unfunded liability. And this is the model that's operational in Michigan very successfully. This is the model that's been adopted now in Oregon and Washington. Additionally, we have, just as in Senate Bill 162, we have raised the retirement age for people under age 40 who are in the defined benefit plan to age 60. So if you're over age 40, and this won't affect you, you need to have that kind of time frame so that those people have enough time to make more money if they choose to go into the defined contribution. We would make that an optional choice for people who want to go into it. I believe the lady's concern about the language on the title in lines 22, 23, and 24 is... that's why you have a political campaign, is to explain to people what the ballot issue is about and what you're trying to accomplish. I think it's pretty clear here that it says that if you're in the defined contribution plan, you can buy any of the, you're not precluded from buying any additional optional insurances you want, and yes, it's on your nickel.
Mr. Paulson.
Yeah, a comment about Social Security. Currently, current employees are not eligible for Social Security. Nothing in this changes that. As far as informing employees, though I've looked at the website that PARA has for employees, I recall that's made very explicit in that their website. I would assume that PARA would continue to make very clear all employees under this plan that they would not be eligible for Social Security. Nothing in this changes that.
And the fact that paramembers do not pay into Social Security is addressed in other statutes, and we make no change to that. So para would want to inform the public that they don't also get Social Security, but frankly, a fallback on Social Security is not that great a deal.
I'm not sure I'm entirely clear yet, but you know, I do see the provision in the measure that says a member of the defined contribution plan may participate in optional life insurance, long-term care insurance, voluntary investment program as provided in this article, which is Article 51. I believe that means other provisions in Article 51 that are not changed by this measure.
That's correct. If they want to participate in the PARA's insurance programs that PARA offers their defined benefit members, they would have that option to do that.
So there's really no change.
Correct.
Is there any change, though, to the benefits? I mean, I'm trying to understand this. Is there anything like disability benefits? Is there something lost in the transition from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan? If, as far as benefits, disability or?
No. No. I mean, in the defined if you're a defined benefit member, you have this other set of benefits. We make no changes whatsoever to that. If you're a new employee beginning in January of 2007, and you're in the defined contribution plan, you have your retirement plan that you are funding and your employer is funding. If you additionally want to participate in the other insurance funds that PARA offers, you have the option to buy into those. Or you can go anywhere else in the private sector and buy into those.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion about the staff draft then. Any suggested changes to the staff draft? Yes, please. Come, you'll come up to the microphone so we make sure we get your remarks on the record, please.
I would like to encourage the proponents to add that Social Security is not going to be an option for these employees. I think that should be clearly stated.
But it's my problem with that is there's no change there. It's not an option right now, is it, for people current?
There's a huge change in the plans. As Christine had pointed out to you, a new employee coming in has the option to purchase the disability. Right now, that is provided through a defined benefit plan. That's the huge change. That, in my opinion, is a huge change. In other words, right now, we are covered by disability. After January 1st, 2007, talking about a new person coming into the plan, as Christine did, she talked about a new person. They would have the option to purchase disability, but it is not provided for them as it is right now. To me, that's a huge difference. And the voters, I believe, should have the opportunity to understand that we do not have a fallback. That public employees do not have a fallback to Social Security. They didn't then, and they wouldn't now. But the fallback there is PARA, the older employees that she was talking about, anybody over 40 is going to go ahead and get grandfathered. We are protected. The new ones coming in, that's my concern, the new people coming in are not going to be provided those protections. And that's the difference. And that's why I want something in this to state that public employees do not pay into Social Security. Hence, they do not have the protections of Social Security.
Don?
Is there a current group of employees that would lose that benefit? Is it somebody under 40? Or? Because I think there are all kinds of benefits for employees, people who are not yet employees, that they will not get when they are employed here, whether or not they're existing benefits today or not. And so I'm not sure it's I'm probably not saying this articulately, but it's not relevant to list benefits that a new employee is not getting because they're not employees now and are not receiving them now.
Well, I think there's a perception out there with the taxpayers that public employees are an elitist group And once they understand, no, really, I think that PERA has been touted an elitist group because we end up getting a guaranteed sum of money when we retire. And so what the public's perception is that we also receive Social Security, which we do not. We haven't paid into it. We're not going to get a benefit for the most part. Some people, yes. Some people had put enough quarters in, and they're able to retire, but their Social Security is reduced. My problem is that the taxpayers are going to look at this and say, oh, that elitist group of para-employees are going to get, you know, X number of dollars, not realizing that this is our one and only retirement plan for the majority of us. This is all we have, and this is the only money that we're going to be able to get. And so that's why I'm pushing so hard for some sort of clarification language about the Social Security.
Right. I think in my mind that's an issue, though, of education during the campaign, for lack of a better word, rather than inclusion in the ballot title, which is designed to reflect what the measure itself does.
Are there suggested changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the statement of single subject, I have a couple of concerns. First of all, I don't know in terms of just the board's practice whether revised statutes should be capitalized. The staff draft has Colorado capitalized. Usually have it all capitalized. But that's one small issue. The other is in terms of the actual description, which right now talks about retirement benefit plans for public employees in Colorado. I have a couple of concerns because we're talking about, in terms of the specific terminology within the measure of defined benefit plan versus a defined contribution plan, and the use of benefit plan in the statement of single subject, whether it covers one but not the other, I mean in a very strict sense. And so whether perhaps we might want to say either retirement benefits or retirement plans or something a little broader that might not be exclusive to everything that's provided in the measure. The other concern I have is in terms of the reference for public employees in Colorado. Not all public employees participate in PRA. For example, fire and police, a lot of times they're controlled by FPPA. In terms of those pensions, you have school districts that don't participate, such as Denver. You have municipalities that don't participate. And so whether we talk about maybe for public employees who participate in PERA, and I spell it out in terms of Public Employees Retirement Association, something to narrow it a little bit, because I'm not sure that the single subject right now, it may be too broad for what the measure is dealing with.
Well, I think it would make some sense, strikes me that it would make some sense to take out the word benefit concerning retirement plans. I don't know that anything is lost there, and it does avoid maybe there's some confusion, given that there's so much, so central to this is the difference between a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan. But I'll take a stab at leaving the public employees portion of it myself, even though it's not all public employees. But as far as just stating the broad subject, I'm wondering if that's still good enough. I mean, as a description of basic subject of the measure. Partly because I'm not quite sure exactly how to satisfactory way of dealing with it, although I think you were suggesting.
If you said something like public employees who participate in the Public Employees Retirement Association, I mean, it'd be nice if you could just refer to PERA. It's a little shorter, but I don't think you can go with the acronym at this point.
Would it be too ambiguous to just say beginning on line 2, for participating public employees in Colorado?
Or say that again?
Just adding participating after 4 in line 2.
I think that begs the question of what are they participating in.
That's what I was afraid of.
But in terms of just, you know, having it so broad, whether at all it's misleading in terms of they think it applies to every public employee when in fact it doesn't, I think it was my only concern.
You know, I guess partly to help me resolve that question in my mind is, does the rest of the title, is it clear enough that it's dealing basically with PERA? Now, I guess that doesn't, though, address your concern about who these public employees are.
Well, or I guess another option, you know, but I don't know that it helps a lot other than it makes maybe the voters aware that you're not talking about all public employees, is you could say for certain public employees. And I agree that once you get into the trailers, I don't think there's any doubt in terms of who you're talking about. It's just that, you know, that's a very broad statement as it's currently drafted in the staff draft. But if you're comfortable, then, I mean, that's fine. It just seemed like we're not dealing with all public employees, that's all.
And that's true. I'm reluctant to say certain public employees.
Because that doesn't tell them much other than it gives them notice that it's something less than all. But
and it might imply a lot less than all. I mean, it's like specific public employees.
I don't want to
tilt this the other way either.
Well, in a way, it is specific public employees.
It's true.
Those that participate in PRA.
Could we just say an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning retirement plans for members of the Public Employees Retirement Association?
Well, I think that, well, I don't know, since you have public employees in the retirement association, maybe that gets that concept.
For
members of the Public Employees Retirement Association, is that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's I like that. Let's try to have, if Bessie will put that on the screen, think about it. And
members of the Public Employees Retirement Association. While she's typing that, that actually raises a question I had, where we have the paren associations, or the definition. My short time on the board, I haven't seen that. Has that typically been done where we define terms in the title for use further in the title?
I don't know that we've done that on a regular basis. I don't know if we have the statement, the full name of the association the first time around. I don't know that it's necessary to have it set off in the parens. I mean, I think you could just refer to the association with the idea being that it's referencing back to the association that you've named in full.
Seems pretty obvious to
me.
I'm okay with taking the parenthetical part out if it is clear enough. So this would be concerning retirement plans for members of the Public Employees Retirement Association.
I'm not sure if we need in Colorado, but
I would suggest striking that.
And I believe there should be a possessive, the employees is plural possessive. No,
after
it's plural possessive.
Yeah.
Public employees.
It's not the name of it.
In the statute, it's plural possessive, the name of the association.
While we're at it, I would suggest capitalizing the first letter in revised statutes. I did look at one example, number 71, that the board did before, and I don't know how consistent we've been, but I think there was at least one example where it was Colorado Revised Statutes was initial capped.
Is to Public Employees Retirement Association? Yeah. First letter capped.
From a drafting perspective, I mean, the statutes don't capitalize anything except proper names. I mean, if you look at the statutes, it's in lowercase.
I suspect we've tended to follow the statutory or the legislative guidelines on capitalization, sometimes, which means not much is capitalized. But
just to follow through with that same amendment, then on lines 3 and 4, we would take out public employees retirement and the parenthetical.
Yeah, can we work on just the single subject first, and then as we go on down? Sure. But I agree with you that then we wouldn't need the full name later.
So I think then, just for the record, the proposed change to the beginning part in the statement of single subject would, it would then read an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning retirement plans for members of the Public Employees Retirement Association, comma.
I'll move that.
That's been moved by Mr. Dunn. I'll second that.
Go ahead.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. So then maybe we should follow through and look at conforming amendments.
I'll make that change.
Go ahead, Mr. Dunn.
In line 3 and 4, taking out public employees' retirement. Subsequent parenthetical. No, leave association. And leave it in the parent. Either one. Yes.
Delete it just so it just
has association. And then delete the parenthetical.
Probably the rest of it will be okay because it probably consistently uses the term association. Under that assumption, Mr. Dunn, is that your motion?
That's my motion.
I'll second that. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other suggested changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks.
Down on, since everything, it's moved a little bit. I think it's in the phrase that starts on line 10, increasing the employee contributions rate for the defined benefit plan by 0.5% of salary every year. I was just wondering whether it would be helpful to say employee salary rather than just salary. I don't know whether that might be helpful in terms of trying to explain. I mean, I know that a lot of this is very technical, but it's that phrase that begins on line 10, increasing the employee contribution rate for the defined benefit plan by 0.5% of salary every year, whether just to insert employee before salary so that it's clear. I mean, I know it talks about employee contribution rate, but to make it clear whose salary it's the 0.5% of each year.
Ms. Burke, did you have come to the podium, if you would, so we get you on the record.
I don't know who else's salary it would be other than the salary of the employee contained within that same one phrase. I mean, it won't hurt it to add the word employee, but it doesn't seem necessary.
And I mean, my only concern is, you know, most people that are reading this have no earthly idea about PRA or retirement benefits or any of those sorts of things. And so it was just an idea that struck me when I was
So you just put
reading.
The employee's salary.
I don't know
that
it's a biggie one way or the other.
I could go either way.
I won't move it.
Okay.
In in terms of the further down the next couple of phrases, modifying the manner in which legal services are provided to the association, I don't know that I view that as a major component of the measure. I also don't know if repealing the authority of members to repurchase forfeited service credit is a major component of the measure, and so I might suggest just striking those two phrases.
Ending in what's now line 12?
Yes, right there where it says he has the cursor. But I'm not sure that phrase or the next really major components of the measure. The measure, the title's pretty long as it is and detailed, whether or not that would help a little bit to simplify.
I agree. Given the length of the title, if there's things that we can shorten, that would be very good. Modifying, I mean, that clause just doesn't say much. And I sure don't see that that's significant. I don't know about the next one, about repealing the authority of members to repurchase forfeited service credit. I don't know. It says something, but I just don't know how significant it is, to be honest with you.
Right. I mean, I think you could make the title a lot more detailed and lengthy if you referenced every single change that the measure does. And I'm just not sure that we'll really need to do that. And those might be just a couple that we could take out to shorten it up a little bit.
I'd agree on the first one. I'm not sure on the second one. Mm-hmm. I guess I would ask for proponent's comment.
Please.
With respect to the first issue on the manner of legal services, I would agree with Ms. Eubanks. I mean, that's a technical issue, and I see it as such. Obviously, if you're from a proponent standpoint, defending it against any kind of a legal challenge, the more stuff you put in there, the easier it is to defend, because the more the other side you take away arguments against, you know, that the opponents will raise, that it doesn't contain something that it should. But I mean, modifying the way in which legal services are provided, I think that's a very difficult one to defend, saying that's got to be in there. With respect to the second measure, however, that the repealing the ability on the service credits, I can just see an argument in any subsequent legal challenge where the opponents will say that is a huge issue for existing employees, and they should be told that up front, particularly existing employees and supporters of existing employees. They should be told that up front in the ballot title. So because that's sort of a hot button issue, if you will, in an abundance of caution, while I agree with everything you said, Ms. Eubanks, about, you know, sort of in a rational world, what would be acceptable, and sometimes the irrationality that is exhibited in the litigation process over some of these measures. Probably the second one that you were talking about should be kept in.
Well, then I would move striking the first phrase regarding legal services, but not the second. So just, yeah.
All the way
to the semicolon? I would so move.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
The only other one I had, let me see if I can find it. Oh, okay. No, that's fine. It's long. I'm looking for something that says requiring certain amounts be directed. Okay, it's on line 20, where it talks about requiring that certain amounts be directed to pay off unfunded liabilities, and I believe this relates to if there's any savings resulting from the defined contribution plan, that's be used to pay off unfunded liability for the defined benefit plan. And I just was wondering if it would be helpful to say, when you say certain amounts, that it's certain amounts of the association versus any potential confusion with that it's employees' monies or something along those lines. But because it just says certain amounts and you don't know whose money you're talking about.
That's a good point. But how to fix that?
And what I thought of, and I'm not bound by it, but just to say requiring that certain amounts of the association be directed to pay off unfunded liabilities in the defined benefit plan.
I think that helps. Any comments from proponents or anyone else? Mr. Paulson?
I think this is an important provision, and I think our expectation is that the amounts that are referred to in this provision would be specifically identified and earmarked for repaying unfunded liabilities. So requiring that certain amounts of the association, not sure how that changes what our intent is here.
And I don't know that it's my intent to change your intent. I'm just trying to be more specific.
Clarify.
As to whose monies we're talking about here.
Okay. That's, I think if that's clarifies it in the minds of the board.
I think the idea is that it's association funds and not some outside source or tax dollars or.
Would funds be a better word than amounts?
Or monies?
Is it appropriate to add the term earmark? The earmark by the association?
Ms. Burt?
A term rather than amounts, you know, providing certain monies might be more clear. Amount of what? And you could say requiring that certain monies of the association be, I think directed actually is the better term, because then that indicates that those monies are going from a source to a source. If you say earmarked, then you're not sure exactly how they transition. Just a little.
May, I think that this phrase is referring to a provision that's on page 14 of the measure. It's in subsection 3, and it's talking about the difference between the employer contribution rate specified in statute versus the actual contribution rates paid by the employer into a defined contribution plan be directed to pay off unfunded liabilities in the defined benefit plan. And then it goes on to refer to savings. And so I'm assuming there's two different, I mean, it's the difference between contribution rates for, I assume, the defined contribution plan versus the defined benefit plan is one pot of money potentially, and the other is just administrative savings in it from resulting from having a contribution plan. So there's two groupings. Can't describe them all as savings, but maybe monies might be more descriptive than amounts. I think.
Really? Typical protocol for using monies or funds, or I thought we had a discussion on that. I
don't know that we've been consistent.
And in terms of Mr. Paulson's suggestion about using the term earmarking, I think the fact that we say certain is supposed to give some indication that the measure specifies what monies are to be used for this purpose without necessarily getting into the details of whether it's been earmarked along that way.
Usual statutory spelling of monies, I think, is M-O-N-E-Y-S, right. Even though that's not a term from the measure here, but I'd suggest maybe as opposed to M-O-N-I-E-S, I would say E-Y-S. Unless there's some objection to that. I know that's a little non-standard for the rest of the world, but.
And so I would move those changes on line 20.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. just so maybe I don't have to end up reading the entire title into the record at the end, then this clause, the motion is to change this clause so that it would read, requiring that certain monies of the association be directed to pay off unfunded liabilities in the defined benefit plan, semicolon. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other suggested changes? I don't have any. If not, is there a motion to adopt the staff drafts as amended with the understanding that the changes that we've adopted, let me just finish that thought, Ms. Bird, I'll recognize you, that the changes that we've made to the ballot title, the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. That's the same thing in the form of a question. Ms. Bird.
Just looking at it, on line 24, we're just missing the last two words. Administered by the association now seems to have pushed into the next page. I mean, just is that any issue for you? No. Okay.
So we hopefully we've actually shortened some things, but in its current form, it lengthened things. So.
Yeah, if Ceci switches it over with the changes,
there you go.
Then it would all be, it shows you without strike type.
So was there a motion to adopt the
I would
staff
so move.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Includes action on number 93. The time is 4:59 p.m. Thank you, everybody. That concludes the board's meeting.